Up next, a look at search engines. It seems like magic. You type in a few words, maybe they're even misspelled, and instantly you get 180 million pages of what you're looking for, whether it's tips on catching largemouth bass or tutorials on playing electric bass. That was my joke. I like that. Actually, it was partly my joke. For the rest of the hour, we'll talk about how your search engine knows what you want, and whether there are any downsides to Google or Yahoo knowing if you're more interested in fishing or rock music. Let me introduce my guests. First, Javed Mustafa. He's a professor of informatics at Indiana University, and he joins us from WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Thank you, Joe.
And also, we have Andrew Keene, author of Cult of the Amateur, out by Doubleday in 2007. He joins us by phone from Palo Alto, California.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for joining us. So I guess, Javed Mustafa, let's start with you. Can you give us just the very simplest explanation of what's going on when you type a search query into a Google search engine?
Well, basically, the query terms are taken and matched with a pre-stored, organized set of information, organized in a manner to make the search fast and efficient and accurate. The search engine is not going out and looking at thousands or hundreds of thousands or even millions of sites at that time. It has already done the pre-organization of the information using sophisticated software like crawlers. So it's taking your terms and just matching it up as fast as it can with a pre-organized, highly organized set of information to find the best list of links for you.
But I'm just wondering, even if you have a program that has a pre-organized list, why is it that it can come back? It seems like the answer comes back at you almost before you finish typing it.
Well, of course, it happens after it has acquired your query terms, but it tries to do it very fast because they're employing some of the best distributed networking technologies. They're employing, in other words, multiple computers to do the search parallelly to save time, to run through many branches of potential answers at the same time. And they're employing very sophisticated algorithms to try to eliminate junk answers or non-relevant answers using many different factors to weigh essentially what could be the relevant answer and try to put them up as high in the list as possible.
We're talking about search engines, how they work, and what they can be used for. We're welcoming your calls at 800-989-8255. That's 989-8255 or talk, TALK. You can just use your search engine, look up those numbers. You'll find us. That's what'll happen. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Okay, so Andrew Keene, we've just heard a brief description of what a search engine does, and that sounds reasonably innocuous. So where do the problems come in from a privacy standpoint?
Well, the problem is that I think many people who use search engines don't realize that the intelligence at the other end of our computer, the thing that is making it so convenient to find things that we were looking for, is actually storing our search requests. So the more we enter into that search engine box, whether it's Google or Ask or Yahoo or Microsoft, the more those companies are learning about our desires, many of which are actually rather intimate, some of which could be potentially embarrassing for us.
I see. Maybe I should go back to you, Dr. Javed Mustafa, and ask, well, is it important that they gather this information to do the search? Is that helping in some way? I mean, why would they want it in the first place?
Sure. They would like to track different types of patterns of searches for certain categories. So, you know, for example, to you know, give emphasis or weight to certain topics more than others, and to understand people's search behavior as a way to improve their system. And over time, they may try to also improve the matching with advertisements so that they can give you more relevant ads alongside the answers.
So is that where the problem is coming, Andrew Keene? Is that where your concern is, or is it really just is it privacy?
Well, I think there's a bigger issue. The traditional search pre-digital revolution was done in the library. Libraries are public services. Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, Ask, these are not public services. These are for-profit organizations. And the way in which search engines are monetized, the way in which they make profit, is through selling advertising around those search engine services. So I think very often people take it for granted that these search engines are public utilities, and they're not.
So is there any public accountability, or is it caveat emptor all the way?
There is
Let Andrew Keene answer this.
Okay.
Well, there's increasingly a public and political debate about how we can manage and indeed even control the amount of information that the search engines are acquiring about us, and limit the length of time which they can maintain those records. Google just committed to maintaining the records for 18 months, but in theory, they can keep that information forever.
And is there any federal, state regulatory body that's supposed to be looking at these guys?
Yeah, I mean, this stuff is now being looked at, and it's actually interesting that it's coming up in the context of Google's acquisition of DoubleClick. And the issues surrounding that in terms of Google increasingly, in some people's mind, being seen as a sort of a dangerously oligarchic force for online advertising.
Well, when we come back, we'll explain what it means for Google to acquire DoubleClick, and maybe we'll even explain what DoubleClick is. But we have to take a short break, and we'll be back, so stay with us. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. We're talking about search engines, and we're talking with Javed Mustafa. He's a professor of informatics at Indiana University, and Andrew Keene is author of Cult of the Amateur. And when we were taking our break just before the break, we were talking about Google's acquisition of DoubleClick. And for those of us who don't find those words completely understandable, Andrew Keene, can you quickly explain what it means and what was DoubleClick and what it does and why Google buying it is a significant event?
Well, DoubleClick is an advertising network. It's not a search engine. But I think the challenges, the issues this raises is that, again, the holy grail for companies like Google is to know us intimately. The more they know about us personally, the more about our buying habits, our passions, our desires, our interests, the more personalized the advertising it can serve up, the more money they can make. So I think the fear on the part of Congress, the FTC, and particularly the European Union, is that Google is essentially becoming, if not a monopolist, a dangerous oligarch in terms of the amassing of personal information about us, and that puts us in a scarily dominant position in terms of this digital marketplace.
Javed Mustafa, you were going to say something earlier.
Yeah, with all due respect to Andrew there, I think we need to be careful in terms of clumping all of those acquisitions against the search engine businesses. There are other businesses that collect huge amount of information, and the same types of acquisitions can be brought against them. For example, the credit card industry. Every time we use our card for whatever transactions, that information could be quite personal also. And the point is, these businesses, I believe, are very, very careful in terms of ensuring that they don't in some ways past that line where, you know, their customers would turn around and say, hey, you're misusing the service that I'm paying for. And in some respect, I don't want to put it all in a kind of an economic solution domain, but the economy does, take care of some of this. I think Google and other search engines are very careful in terms of how they're using that information. And we can, you know, get all worked up and very extremely scared about what's going on with all the searches we're doing. But they may be hurting themselves if they are not smart and careful in terms of the way they use their information.
Well, let's go to the phones now and see what our callers are making of all this. And let's start with Jen in Baltimore. Welcome to Science Friday, Jen.
Hello.
Hello.
I was just wondering, when you're designing a website, do keywords matter anymore? And I think a couple years ago, Google used to say repeat important terms in your keywords, and then another search engine or Google or somebody else contradicted that with don't repeat the title in your keywords. And anyway, do keywords matter anymore?
Interesting. John and Mustafa?
Yeah, they do. As long as you don't overdo it. You know, there are sites that purposefully place excessive redundant information so that as a way to try to boost up their ranking. That may, in fact, negate your ranking if they figure out what you're trying to do. But you know, as long as you use a certain number of important words carefully and use them in a natural way as possible, they are important. They are going to be taken into consideration.
Let's take another call now. Go to Catherine in Alexandria, Virginia. Catherine, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. I wanted to get your comments on what seems to me to be a problem in Google. I love Google, but I think it has a bias built into the algorithm that works against original work that may challenge established authority, either scholarly work or ideas that have some possible commercial application. Since the algorithm stresses citations, and the more citations, the more repetition, so that you get, you know, one paper referred to 100 times. If secondary thinkers or researchers pick up on the original ideas and may use them with less integrity to the original, they may become the established authority and blot out the access of the public or the, you know, interested persons to that original material.
What you're referring to is the link analysis component that Google takes into account to to try to come up with a ranking that's more accurate.
Yeah.
There is a broader issue, and this again has been in the law courts in Europe, of how much information Google actually should be able to be giving in the link before it actually can be accused of taking other people's content. And that's another very, very interesting issue, I think, involved in the limitation on search engines and their role and responsibility in our culture.
Is this a copyright question, Andrew Green?
Yeah, this is a copyright question.
I see. So in other words, Javier Mustafa.
Yeah, I think, again, I think we need to calm down a little bit. In terms of the original question, if someone has an extremely bright, fantastic idea, but it doesn't get the uptick, if you will, and doesn't get cited or linked a sufficient number of times, I can see from that perspective a problem. But if it's truly a genuinely interesting idea, there are other channels for that idea to get out. We have established channels for people to publish, to go out and seek a venue to talk about that idea. We need to not lose sight of those things either. So I think
I'd also like to respond to one of Professor Mustafa's points.
Sure. Sure. Yep.
About comparing credit card companies and search engines. I think that's a very fair point. I think the problem is that these search engines now need a lot more disclosure to the consumer about what they can and can't do with the information being put in. I think many of the listeners will not be aware that the information they put into search engines is remembered or potentially remembered. And I think that search engines have a responsibility to make it much clearer to their users about what they aren't and are, what they are, what they can and can't do with the information that's being put into them.
Well, let me ask you, Andrew Keene, what would you think would be the best way of giving that information? Because you know that they all require you to click a button that say, I agree with these terms, or I've read your policy statement, and I'm certain that most people just click the button so they can keep going. I mean, how do you
Absolutely.
Get this?
Absolutely. I mean, no, who looks at that small print,
right,
especially
so...
online? I think it needs to be up front. I think this is a question of educating the public. And I think ultimately it will establish a much better relationship.
So who should write that material, do you think? Because I'm just wondering, I mean, the company, of course, is going to say we're pure as the driven snow and there's nothing to worry about. And perhaps some advocates would think that they're all a nefarious plot to be, you know, have our identity stolen. So who is the arbiter here?
Well, I think that the company has a responsibility to explain how long potentially they can keep that information, what a cookie is, and how they will and won't use this information. I mean, other consumer companies have that responsibility.
I have to say, yeah. not to be specific to any particular, but I happen to just be looking through a site that someone just showed me called LinkedIn. I guess I'm the last person in America to know about this. But they were actually quite explicit in many of the things you're just describing. It described what a cookie was in a broadcast, I forgot, it's something now, a broadcast siren or something like that. And I thought it was I was learning things as I was going, and I did it did make me pause. But
and I think it's in the search engine company's interest because ultimately they want to establish closer relationships with their users, and I think the less they reveal, the more of a potential backlash there can be with these users once they understand that it's not quite as simple as it appears.
Yeah. Let's take another call now and go to Gary in Sacramento. Gary, welcome to the program.
Hey, good afternoon or good
afternoon.
Morning.
Sure.
I heard once that only a small percentage of what's really out on the internet, of the entirety of what's on the internet, is accessed by any search engines or search engines. I was wondering just what that percentage is currently, and how does one go about reaching that part that normal search engines don't find?
Javed Mustafa, what about that?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. The caller is, I think, referring to what's called the deep web sometimes, which is a segment much larger than the current web or the surface web, where information is available for searching and people use that information all the time. Some of that information is behind firewalls, behind protected subscription-based login accounts where Google or any other public search engine systems which rely on crawlers to go out and grab pages and index them cannot get to. For example, some of you may be aware of LexisNexis as a service, which is a paid-for service. You have to set up an account to go in and search their database. Well, that information is not available in Google. There are many, many other resources like that that is in the deep web. As far as numbers, I have some just rough numbers and somewhat old numbers. This comes from a study done at Berkeley titled How Much Information Is There? And the surface web is approximately, in terms of terabytes, 167 terabytes, whereas the deep web is 91,000 terabytes. And just
Whoa.
for a comparison, they estimate the Library of Congress has about 11 terabytes of data.
Wow,
I think it's
so.
Important also to note that all the dominant search engines are based on an artificial intelligence, on an algorithm, which isn't always very effective. And there's an interesting reaction now in Silicon Valley that the one of the big stories of the summer is the founding of a new search engine called Mahalo, M-A-H-A-L-O, which is based on human search of professional experts putting together much more accurate search engines. So it's also possible to argue that whether or not Google can access all the information, a lot of the stuff it serves up isn't very relevant or helpful.
We're talking with Andrew Keen. He's the author of The Cult of the Amateur, a book published by Doubleday, and Javed Mustafa, a professor of informatics at Indiana School of Informatics and Indiana University. And we're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's take another call now. And shall we go to Ed in Grand Rapids, Michigan? Ed, welcome to the program.
Thank you. You mentioned earlier the acquisition of DoubleClick by Google, and I just wanted to bring up if you weren't going to, DoubleClick had a reputation as a really sleazy outfit. They were one of the largest banner ad places, and they were known for keeping an ID from site to site. So you go across a half dozen sites, and it will know that it was you who hit site number one, and then site number two, and then site number three, even if they're completely unrelated and don't share information, because they had the banner ads from the same company on those sites, and they could track you. And I don't know. I was wondering if that had played into anybody's.
I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know if I'm comfortable with the characterization of DoubleClick as sleazy, but Andrew Keen, would you call them at one extreme of the spectrum in terms of how they hide information?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to comment on DoubleClick in terms of its ethics. I mean, these are all for-profit companies. I think there's a broader issue then again with Google. I've talked about the analogy with the library. The interesting thing about Google is, as a search engine, it's seen and often viewed and used as a public service. But not only Google is acquiring companies like DoubleClick, but also companies like YouTube, which are entertainment companies. So when one does one search on Google, it also raises some interesting issues. When someone enters in a video network, would you expect... And when you do that at the library, you know that you're going to get objective information. But when you do it at Google, or for that matter, Yahoo or Microsoft, they're all in the same business of acquiring companies in different spaces. Can we always rely on these search engines to serve up objective results, when often from a commercial point of view, it might benefit the search engine to tell us to take us to one place as opposed to somewhere else?
Go ahead, Jonathan.
I'd like to make a point.
Sure.
You referred to my affiliation as School of Informatics. I want to say that at Indiana, my home base is actually in School of Library and Information Science. So I do know something about the library world to some degree. In terms of the type of information, first of all, Google currently serves up. Obviously, the main Google search engine is not aimed at scholars. It's aimed at a much larger, broader public use. It does have a different search system called Google Scholar. And in terms of libraries and Google working with libraries, many libraries, large research libraries, in fact, libraries such as University of Michigan, Harvard, Oxford, are beginning to collaborate with Google because they see a value of the technology of producing highly accurate, useful information for scholars. So we need to take a look at the broader development that are going on. And Microsoft also, I believe, is very interested in digitizing books and working with libraries, too, with their search engine system.
So just to finish quickly, Andrew Keen, there's no question that these are useful services. You're just looking for a way to sort of bring them under more accountability.
Absolutely. Transparency and accountability and public education. I think we need to understand that these are for-profit organizations. There's nothing wrong with that, but they're not purely public services. They're not libraries.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm afraid that's where we'll have to leave things. I'd like to thank my guest this hour, Javed Mustafa. He's a professor at Indiana University, and Andrew Keen is the author of the new book, Cult of the Amateur. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you very much, Joe.
Neil Ellis is our technical director. Our audio engineer is Sean Phillips. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarian Joelle Estrelli. If you have comments or questions, write to us at Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Or you can email us. The address is scifry@npr.org. Check out sciencefriday.com for more information and links to the program you heard today. You can listen to past editions of Science Friday online or take them with you as a podcast. Ira Flatow will be back next week. For NPR News in Washington, I'm Joe Palca.